Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Liberal, Objectivist, Conservative, Divergent Voices in America. Recorded in 1998, Dennis McQuestion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, hosts a discussion about three distinct ideological frameworks with CPAE professional speaker and author Phil Wexler, philosopher and author Leonard Peikoff, and chair and CEO of the Eagle Forum, Phyllis Schlafly. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Abortion, welfare, government spending, taxes, the economy, affirmative action. All these subjects are important, and in the 8 years we've been producing this program, we focused on them and many more. And because the odds are that you've seen many of them, would you agree with me when I marvel at how our very intelligent panelists and audience members can hold totally opposite views on many important issues? Now, on this program, you're in for a unique experience. We're going to look at the issues I mentioned through the eyes of a conservative, a liberal, and an objectivist. We'll examine their divergent views and the philosophies upon which they're based. Now, our goal is that by the end of the program, you will be better able to make decisions on important issues and understand why you and the others hold such differing views. Let's begin by meeting our conservative from St. Louis, who is joining us by satellite. Phyllis Schlafly needs no introduction to most conservatives. She is president of Eagle Forum, a national pro-family organization she founded in 1972. She's the author of 16 books. Her monthly newsletter is in its 31st year. Her syndicated columns appear in 100 newspapers, and 270 radio stations hear her commentaries on her radio talk show. Please welcome Ms. Phyllis Schlafly. Phyllis, we are delighted to have you. And
Thank you.
I know that you're so active in all these issues. I must tell you a little bit of history. When we first started this program, in fact, the pilot for it before we started the program was in 1985. The first topic we did was abortion. You have been at the cutting edge of what needs to be done, in your opinion, and should be done. Tell us for a moment just what your position is as it relates to abortion as we see it today at the close of the 20th century.
Well, the issues really haven't changed since then, but science has come along in recent years and told us so much more about what is going on in the womb of the woman that we didn't know when I was having my children. We now know that when the DNA of the father unites with the DNA of the mother, we have a unique individual that has come into human life. We know that 3 days after conception, we can tell whether this is male or female. So it must be a human male or female. And we also know that we can see the pictures in the first 2 months of after conception, which are so wonderful. I'm not talking about the ultrasound. I'm talking about real pictures taken with cameras that show the developing baby. The skin is transparent at that age, and you can see the heart beating through the skin. You can see the organs functioning. So we know that it is a baby, and it is a tragedy in our society that some people take it upon themselves to kill this human life. The cheapening of human life, I think, is a great tragedy of our time.
Thank you, Phyllis. And joining us here in the studio, I'd like to first introduce you to Leonard Peikoff. Dr. Peikoff is a philosophic writer and teacher. He is Ayn Rand's legal and intellectual heir. He was a close associate of Ayn Rand for 30 years, and he's the author of the book Objectivism, The Philosophy of Ayn Rand. He lives in Los Angeles, California, where he hosts a syndicated talk show entitled Philosophy, Who Needs It? Please welcome Leonard Peikoff. Leonard, we're glad you're here. And sitting next to you is Phil Wexler. Phil Wexler calls himself an unrepentant free market liberal from La Jolla, California. He's a professional speaker on sales and customer service, the co-founder of Le Concierge, the largest executive concierge service in America, and a guy who is always on the cutting edge of liberal ideas. Please welcome Phil Wexler. Phil, you've just heard what Phyllis has to say. Give us your thoughts.
Well, I have believed for a very long time that one of the biggest mistakes that the pro-choice movement has made is they've allowed the discussion to center on when does human life begin. And it is inevitable as science progresses that that definition will constantly change, and we probably will never know truly when we define something as a human being. I think the issue of abortion should not be centered on that issue. The issue of abortion should be centered on a conflict of rights. The courts have had to, and society has had to rule when the rights of one human being come in conflict with the rights of another human being throughout history. We clearly have a conflict between the rights of the fetus and the rights of the mother. And I think that if you use the historical criteria that that we as a society have used to choose between conflicts of rights, that clearly the rights of the mother to not be a slave and to have choice of what she does with her body overrule any other choices.
There would be those who would say that the mother has a choice not to get pregnant to start with. How would you answer that?
I would say that she probably did have that right, that choice, and we all make mistakes.
All right. Leonard, you've heard from the right and from the left. Where are you?
I disagree with both viewpoints. I think it is an issue that the mother has a right and the fetus has no right, because the fetus is not, contrary to what Phyllis said, a human being. A fetus is a potential, but not an actual human being, just as an acorn is a potential, but not an actual oak tree. And I think you do have to draw the line. And I say a necessary, essential condition of being a human being is being an entity, first of all, a self-supporting, self-generated entity biologically. That is something that can live without being attached to technology and without being embedded in a womb. And until that point occurs, what you have is simply a potential with no rights, and therefore I'm entirely on the side of the right of the mother. I call my position pro-life because the only living person is the mother.
Interesting. Phyllis, you've now heard what they've had to say. Your reply, please.
Well, when you send a man out into space, he can't live unless he's attached to something else. So I don't think whether you're attached to something else should be the criterion to decide. Also, it is not the mother's body. We know it is an entirely different entity. And if it's not a living, growing human being, then just forget it. But it won't go away. You know it won't. It's going to grow and get bigger and pop out, and sometimes it pops out at 7 months or earlier, and we see that it is a baby. I suggest that these gentlemen look at the pictures of the unborn child in the first 2 months of pregnancy, and there's no question in your mind but what it is. It is not an appendix. It is a baby.
Let me follow up on that, and we do have a lot of issues to go to, so we can't spend all the time on this. But, Leonard, would you agree that there is some point in time in which an abortion would not be appropriate? And let's say the last, particularly the last trimester, this partial birth abortion thing, which has been a major issue in Washington. Is there any point prior to birth that you would say it's incorrect?
I think that there are many cases where abortion is immoral. In other words, if it's a whim-worshipping act on the part of the woman, that is irrational. It's just as immoral as it would be if you kill an animal causelessly or irrationally, or you rip up a flower bed. But the question is, when does the issue of rights enter the question? When does the government properly come in and say, this is illegal and this is a crime? And I say that point comes with viability in the sense of separate existence. And I don't equate existing in the mother with existing in a spaceship. I exist in this room, and without the heat and so on, I couldn't survive. But that does not destroy the difference between being physically formed to the point where you can survive without and be your own source of energy, as opposed to being encased in somebody else's body. You're technically a parasite of that.
Right. Phil, at partial birth abortions.
Viability. Independent life in and of itself. I think that up until that point, it is a woman's decision to do with her body what she chooses.
All right. Now, let me move on to the next issue. The next issue is prayer in schools. One of the things I think all of you would agree with, I may be wrong about this, I'm trying to get some agreement on this program, I promise you. But would it be fair to say that there are some issues of violence in schools, there are some issues of juvenile crime, there are some issues of lack of good education going on right now, that this sort of let anything go standard that we've used, or lack of a standard that we've used, are a problem? And is one of those ways that we can improve the situation moving back to a more moral position, or maybe using prayer in schools, in your estimation, Phil?
Absolutely not. In public schools. In private schools, if you want to send your child to a private school of any denomination you choose, I have no concern with what they do there. People always use the phrase, they always accuse the liberals in this area of trying to create a religion-free zone. Yes, that's what I'm trying to do. If I have to send my child to school, the law requires that. If I have to send my child to school, I have a right to send them to a school where I do not have to worry about anyone trying to influence my child philosophically, intellectually, and religiously in a way that is contrary to my beliefs. I believe prayer does not belong in school. I believe that the conservative elements in our country have tried to make an issue out of a non-issue. They say that they actually say out loud that the Supreme Court outlawed prayer in school. The Supreme Court did not outlaw prayer in school. The Supreme Court outlawed a very narrow definition of prayer in school. Your child can still pray in school to themselves quietly. I believe that the reason the conservative element in this country wants prayer in school is not so that their kids can pray. They want prayer in school so that my kids will pray. And I can make that decision for myself, and so can my children make that decision for themselves.
All right. We've heard your approach, and that's a classic liberal approach, I suppose. Leonard, how do you feel about the issue of prayer in schools?
Well, I certainly don't think that prayer should be permitted in the public schools. In the private, they can do what they choose. But I would add, I don't think if your concern is morality, anybody should pray. You should be free to pray as a part of a free country. But prayer is the attempt to communicate with the supernatural. It's the abandonment of reason in favor of faith. And I think that that is a very immoral thing to do. Man survives by the use of his mind, by thought. And an act of prayer is antithesis to an act of thought. And from that point of view, I'd say if morality is what you're concerned with, teach children logic. Don't teach them submission, obedience, and blind acceptance, which is what prayer involves.
Phyllis, it's to you.
Well, I'm certainly not in favor of forcing anybody else's children to pray in school. But I would agree with Phil that we cannot let the public schools enforce somebody else's dogma on our children, which is contrary to the parents' values. But that is exactly what we've had in the last 20 years through the techniques called values clarification. And now it's called decision making. But what this does is to teach the child that there isn't any eternal truth, that he doesn't need to abide by his parents' views or his church's views, that he can make his own decisions about moral dilemmas and do whatever he is comfortable with. And this is an affirmative downgrading of the values that the child has come to school with. And I think that is absolutely wrong. And that is what why we have seen so many children who are simply cut loose from what their families believe. And I believe that that is absolutely wrong for the public schools to do that. I do not believe the public schools have any right to downgrade the values of the parents and teach the child that what his parents taught him was not true.
Phyllis, we may have a situation where we can agree on here. I'm real nervous about this. Phil, do you agree with that?
Well, I think the where we depart, conceptually at the highest level, we probably just agree that there shouldn't be prayer in school. But when you get down to the level where we start talking about universal values, I'm going to start sounding like Leonard. This has to be based on reason. The concept of blind faith is anathema to me. I believe that we are creatures of reason, and there is no empirical evidence that draws me to the conclusion of God and to prayer and faith. What my future holds for me and for my children is based on reason and logic and the ability to observe the real universe and sometimes infer from that conclusions that aren't concrete, but at least I can infer from concrete ideas what is in fact reasonable. I've never seen a muon, but I have a reasonably good belief that it exists because we can observe things that happen because a muon exists. God requires a leap of faith. It requires bridging the gap. I'm not willing to do that.
Phyllis?
Well, Leonard can believe whatever he wants, but the question is, can he teach that to the children in the public schools? And I would say absolutely not, because most people do believe in God, and the schools have no business telling them that God doesn't exist, that reason is the only thing you can pay attention to.
I think the only solution is to abolish the public schools. In private schools, let each parent pick the philosophy that he wants to teach his children and pay for it. and then there won't be a problem. I want to say I agree with something important that Phyllis said. She legitimately objects to the fact that the public schools, while banning God, are busy pushing relativism and skepticism down the throats of the students. And I think that's completely unfair. It's an example of what happens when you give education over to the government. But we should not have to choose between supernaturalism and relativism. There should be such a thing as a rational ethics, which is neither, which is what I advocate. But it should be up to private citizens to finance what they choose.
All right. And we have a couple of people in the audience who want to say something before we move to our next issue. So, Paul, you're up.
That was a true Ayn Randism. you thought you had agreement, and you don't. I think the prayer in the public schools is largely a red herring. I think it is something that's constantly pushed by people who have another agenda. I think it goes far beyond prayer in schools. There was a show on network TV just a night or two ago that demonstrated there are thousands of so-called prayer clubs in public schools all over the country. So prayer is going on in public school everywhere. The question is, whose prayer is it going to be that's said over the loudspeaker in the morning? I think that's where the objection is, that my prayer may not be your prayer, and your prayer may not be my prayer. So if they want to have prayer clubs and people who are like-minded get together and pray together, that's fine with me. But for a universal prayer in public school, I'm very opposed to it.
Okay. Thank you. Lance, you want to jump up here and give us your 2 cents worth?
Well, Leonard already said it. I mean, the real problem, I think, is that it's a bogus issue, is that it's not prayer in schools, it's government in schools. And government is not equipped to any better equipped to provide food on our table than it is to educate our children. And once you get the equation of government out of the system altogether, let the individual parents decide how they want their children to be raised under whatever values they are, then we won't have this issue at all of prayer in schools.
Okay. Thanks, Lance. Sterling, you want to get? No, all right. Let me move to the next issue then. And I know we haven't solved, and our objective tonight is, again, is not to solve these issues, but merely to illuminate them in terms of how you look at them. The segue I'm going to use is the government issue here. You've talked about it, what government should do. So let me ask you, Leonard, start with you on this question. What is the proper function of government, and where do you see that today?
I think the proper function of government was outlined in the Declaration of Independence, to protect specifically the rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness from being violated by force or fraud. This includes only, in my judgment, the functions of the police to protect you from domestic violence, the military from foreign aggressors, and the courts to resolve disputes so that citizens don't have to take to the streets and fight each other. And other than that, it should be laissez-faire. There should be no welfare state. There should be nothing, no regulation, no alphabet agencies, no progressive income tax. Everything that has been done to dilute and destroy the Founding Fathers' original legacy should be repealed. As to where we are today, we're well over halfway point from the Founding Fathers to Adolf Hitler or Lenin. And I think that it's about time we stopped and changed our direction.
Okay, Phyllis, how do you feel about the proper role of government?
Well, I think the proper role of government was definitely set out not only in the Declaration of Independence, but also in the Constitution. And I do not think the federal government should be doing anything except that which is authorized by the Constitution. And the earlier speaker is absolutely correct. The government is doing all kinds of things today that is not authorized by the Constitution. We're supposed to be have a government of delegated powers, and I just don't believe in the federal government taking over the curriculum in the classroom, taking over and establishing thousands of crimes that have no business to be crimes, all kinds of things that the federal government is doing. If we would just obey the Constitution, we'd be a whole lot better off. I do believe the Founding Fathers devised a system. Nobody's thought up a better way.
Phyllis, let me follow up with you on that and ask you this. And it's a question that I've and sometime soon I'm going to do a program with Dick Armey and some other folks about, and that is this. It seemed from the Republican, I'm not going to try to equate just conservatives with Republicans, but in the election of 1994, there seemed to be sort of a Republican revolution, so to speak. They were going to do all these things. They were going to cut taxes. They were going to cut back on expenditures, lower the size of government. Am I missing something, or do I see a situation in which it appears to me that this may not actually be the case? It seems to be just sort of more of the same. And Gore Vidal said it on C-SPAN a couple of weeks ago. He said there seems to be one political party, and that political party is corporate. Do you agree with that or not?
Well, I don't know if it's corporate, but we do get the impression that we have one-party government in a lot of ways. There are many of the important issues that Clinton and Lott and Gingrich agree on. And I do think that the Republicans who were elected in 94, 96, who were not the majority because they went into a situation where the older guys had all the committee chairmanships, were not able to do what we expected them to do. And it is very disappointing to the grassroots across the country. We did expect this Congress to cut taxes, to cut the size of government, and to get rid of many of these mischievous agencies.
Phil, you're the liberal in the group. Now, you can't listen to this stuff without just going absolutely nuts. We need some activist government here, don't we, or not?
I believe in an activist government, yes.
All right. What should we be doing as government?
Well, I think that in 1998, in the what is supposed to be the most civilized country in the world, I think that for someone to go to sleep hungry, for someone to go to sleep without health care, for someone to go to sleep without shelter, is a blight on our culture. And I believe that that there is some government responsibility in that area. I think that being a free market liberal, the mechanism through which that is distributed, I might disagree with a lot of mainstream liberals, but I think that the marketplace can probably do a better job of it than government can, but I'm not sure I don't want the government mandating it. I think I do want the government mandating it.
Leonard?
I'd like to ask you a question. Why is the fact that somebody is hungry a claim on people who aren't hungry? Why?
We altruism, and I know how you feel about that.
That's the right answer. I mean, in other words, by altruism, you mean each of us has a moral obligation to sacrifice for the needy around the world, regardless of justice, regardless of what we've done to earn what we have. The fact that they don't have it entitles them to it, and the fact that we have it requires us to lose our right to it.
Well, I think there's another factor, though. When you put it in those terms. No one could disagree with what you just said.
But you just did.
Well, because I'm going to add another facet to it. I'm going to say that, when we get back to education, it is important to me not just that my children be educated, but I want them to live in an educated world. So I think that in a truly enlightened society, I would probably agree with you 100%. Because I could trust every one of these people and the rest of the population to do that in their own self-interest, because they want to live in an enlightened society.
But how are they going to be?
This is not an enlightened society. So therefore, I cannot trust the world to protect the weak and to protect the poor and the oppressed throughout the world.
Then you're letting Washington enlighten us?
I'm not. I am letting me enlighten us. I'm relying on the fact that everybody gets to walk into the door and cast their ballot the way they choose, and sometimes we make good choices and sometimes we make bad choices, but the choices we make are the ones we have to live with. And I believe that there is a legitimate role of government in social welfare, in protecting
Phyllis,
the world.
Phyllis, jump in
look,
there.
But look, this is the liberal mindset of enforcing their views on everybody else. Where does he get the authority to say that a government should do this? He must get it out of his mind, his soul, or whatever, because it's not in the Constitution. And I think this is the liberal mindset of an attempt to impose their views on the rest of us, to tell us that it is our obligation to act and perform and pay taxes as they decide for the purposes that they think are good. And where do they get that authority? Who gave them that authority?
Well,
Phil, where did you get that authority?
I'm going to bolster Leonard here for a minute. I get it from the same authority that gives the conservatives the right to tell me what I can read and what movies I can see and what movies can be produced.
Look, that is absolutely false. Conservatives are not telling you that.
Oh, of course they are.
No, they are absolutely not telling you what you can read. And I'm glad you brought up reading. But just compare the literacy of our country today with the literacy at the before there was any government involvement in education whatsoever. We now have about 50% of our population that is only semi-literate or completely illiterate.
The statistics,
all this has happened since the federal government took over education.
The historical statistics on literacy didn't include significant portions of the population because we treated them as non-entities. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about what literacy was in the 1800s, especially in the early 1800s, we can talk about the wonderful literacy rate we had among white Anglo-Saxon Protestants and men. Today, we count everybody. So if you want to compare the literacy today to the literacy then,
today.
Let's count the whole population then, not just the segment that was literate.
But just count the literacy among the whites today, and you'll find it's pretty poor.
Where does the government, if education is a valuable commodity, and you're a free market liberal, and you agree that the free market is the greatest provider of food and clothing and shelter, why wouldn't it equally be the greatest provider of education? Where does the authority of the government come from on such a sensitive issue as the basic ideas that create your civilization to have the right to put the gun on someone and have a public school system? How do you get that?
The government doesn't put the gun on someone to go to that public school. We all have the right. I mean, there are
if
private
you can afford
schools.
It.
There are private schools. There are home schools. There are all different mechanisms of schools that I can use to educate my children if I choose to. But I believe that there must be a place for those who cannot afford it.
Why?
I believe that. I think that
that's your faith. But then that's not open in a rational discussion.
It damages all of us if we live in an illiterate society.
Well, absolutely. That's why I say get the government out, because no one can read as well as in Albania today, thanks to the government.
Okay, let me see if I can regain control of this for just a second. The three of you are doing very well, by the way. I have a gentleman here who wants to make a comment, a lady over here, and then we'll go to our next issue. Go ahead, Turley.
Well, I think one question has not been answered by Phil. And it was posed by both Leonard and Ms. Shafley, and that is the authority. You disagree that the conservatives have the authority to impose all sorts of things that you say they're imposing.
Mm-hmm.
And she disagrees that the liberals have the authority. My question is, where does the authority come from? And since we are in a constitutional form of government with specifically delegated powers, the government doesn't have the right to do things, it's delegated certain powers. My question is, if it's not found in the Constitution, you don't like what's in the Constitution, there's a way of changing it.
Well,
amend it to give public education, it to do these things, but it's not in there now. So where do you get the authority to spend taxes, which did come about through a constitutional mechanism, on arts, on education, on welfare, the safety net. You said you believe in these things, but where's the authority come from?
Well, I think the authority comes from, I think you've answered the question yourself. It comes from the people. We elected those people who passed those laws, and we continue to elect them. If we want those things to stop, then people like Leonard and Phyllis, who disagree with them, should run congressmen and senators to be elected, and they will vote against those things, and we the people will take those things away. But if you're asking me where the authority comes from, it comes from the people.
Leonard.
But this country was not founded with the idea of unlimited majority rule and anything goes, which is what led Socrates to his death. This was founded on the idea of absolute inalienable rights regardless of the public vote, passion, or desire. So Phil is entirely wrong if he says, well, we'll solve everything by majority vote. The purpose of majority is to choose the personnel of government, not its principles.
Phyllis?
Well, that's right. I think all of these areas, it is the liberals who are enforcing their views on us, taking the money out of our pockets to do what they believe is good for society. And there is no authority in the Constitution for the whole field of education at the federal level. And they are just completely pulling it out of the sky and trying to ram it down our throats because they got control of a majority and they want to vote it regardless of the Constitution.
Thank you. Now, another comment from the audience.
Well, I have a question. It seems to me that there's a general mindset that we should be responsible for other people, as Phil is saying, and that they have certain rights, and if they can't achieve those rights, then we are responsible for helping them to achieve those rights. Now, I know if I went out onto the street and the general public and said, it's not my responsibility that you're homeless, people would probably gasp in horror and think that I was really cruel. But to say that we are all responsible for everybody else is to say that is to create a system where you have a parasite who feeds off other people. So it seems to me that you are advocating parasitic situation, that it's okay for people to be parasites to live off of other people. Would you agree with that?
No, phrase that way, no. But let me ask you a question. A young woman, 6 months pregnant, no money, no insurance, shows up at the doorstep of the hospital. She's bleeding. She's clearly in a very dire situation. Do we leave her at the doorstep? Is she roadkill?
Well, I think the real question is whose responsibility? And she is the person responsible for her situation, not us.
Yeah, you're talking about it on a conceptual level. She's standing at the door of the hospital. What do we do?
Do you distinguish between emergency on a voluntary basis and help in an emergency versus government institutionalized responsibility for the needs of ordinary life?
Well, I think that I could present an argument that if we had a reasonable system of health care for that person, she wouldn't be standing there bleeding in an emergency. She would have been taken care of along the way,
and
it wouldn't have happened.
And a reasonable system would have been a free market system, which Hillary has tried to put an end to.
Well, before the government got into the healthcare business, all those people standing at the door were taken care of. We had a wonderful charitable system that took care of those people. Now, the big fault with the healthcare system is what Congress has done in this discriminatory system we have, by which if you work for a large company, you get tax-deductible health insurance, but if you work for a small company that doesn't have health insurance, you're a part-timer or you're self-employed, you cannot get your your health insurance tax deductible. This is grievously unfair. It's the fault of the federal government getting into the whole picture, and we'd be much better off if they would get out of it altogether.
Here, here.
Let me get a couple more comments from the audience and we'll move on.
Seems to me the proof lies in the pudding. I think we've been in a liberal philosophy now for about 50 years, and it seems to me that crime, lawlessness, drug addiction, and poverty and homelessness is worse today than it was when we started. I really have a problem with this, because I have to be honest with you, I'm a reformed liberal. And I used to think that this all sounded wonderful, but I'm looking at it now and I say, it's not working.
Well, are you assuming a cause and effect? I mean, we have two sets of data that we can both agree on, and you're ascribing one as an effect of the other, and I'm saying I have no proof that one is an effect of the other. Do statistics lie, or do statisticians lie? The clear-cut answer to that is there are ways of interpreting the statistics based on segments of the population and the growth of the segment where crime existed, rather than growth of crime in the total population, that belie the myth that liberalism causes crime. Or liberalism causes drugs.
Well, sure, there are a lot of different causes of all those social ills, but it's pretty true that if you subsidize poverty, you're going to get more poverty. If you subsidize illegitimacy, you're going to get more illegitimacy. If you subsidize homelessness, you're going to get more homelessness.
Leonard, where's the empirical proof of that?
Plus, well, I don't think you need, there's plenty of empirical proof, but the trouble with empirical proof is that professors analyze it and can go in any direction with it. But you can argue very simply, how could you possibly not have explosive crime in a situation where the leading criminal is the government, which expropriates more from us than the total mafia would ever dream of seizing? Yearly.
Okay, one quick comment, please.
I'm still baffled by the why. You brought up the scenario of the pregnant woman standing at the hospital in a dire situation. Why is it incumbent upon the government or me or that hospital to be responsible for that person? She obviously knew how to get herself into the situation. Why should it not be her responsibility? Why is it the government or me?
That is a wonderful philosophical discussion. My question to you is, she's standing there. We're out of the world of philosophy. We're in the real world. She's standing there. What do you do with this person?
In the real world, your solution as a vowed man of reason who doesn't want to take the leap of faith is to recite the Sermon on the Mount. How do you justify that?
I have to go back to the question.
I have this sneaking suspicion that we're not going to get agreement on this issue. So, let me move on. Phyllis, let me move on to an area that is extremely important to all of us in this country. That's the issue of foreign policy. Give us your feeling about that. Where are we? What should we be doing? And are we making some mistakes there now, in your estimation?
Well, President Clinton went to the UN last fall, and he set forth his plan. He said he wanted to take us into a web of international organizations, which would be the emerging international system of the 21st century. And he specifically mentioned the World Trade Organization, the Chemical Weapons Treaty, the Global Warming Treaty, and the NATO Expansion Treaty. And they're not the only treaties he's for. He's for the UN Treaty on the Rights of the Child, the UN Treaty on Women. He's for the Biodiversity Treaty, for the International Criminal Treaty, and all these treaties. And each one of these treaties sets up a global organization that diminishes in some way our sovereign right to handle our own affairs. And I think it is a terrible mistake. Now, the one that's coming up next is the NATO Expansion Treaty. This is a go-to-war treaty. This is an absolute commitment to send American men and women to defend the borders of Eastern Europe that those people have been fighting about for 1,000 years. We have no reason to do that. And yet that's what he's pushing, and it looks like he may get it.
Phyllis, let me follow up with you there. If there is a truth about the 20th century, and there are many, I think that all three of you would agree that we have become much more of a global society. I mean, people travel much more. We're in constant contact through satellites, telephone, the internet.
Yeah, but that
doesn't that change things or not?
That doesn't mean that we need to subsidize corrupt Asian regimes. They're putting through the IMF bailout to make us pay for it. Every time they talk about the global economy, that means they're taking money out of our pocket to subsidize these anti-free market, corrupt, dishonest regimes in Asia. And I say, no, we don't want that.
And some of those subsidies obviously go to banks in the U.S. We
Absolutely.
Also know that. Leonard, how do you feel about this issue?
The issue being foreign policy, I agree with everything that I gathered Phyllis said. We should get out of the UN. There should be no international connections. We should have a policy that's of totally United States interest first. And in that regard, the first thing we have to do is establish that we are a credible superpower. If we allow other nations to run riot over us and continuously appease and negotiate and beg for existence, we are finished. And I'm thinking here specifically not of Iraq, but of Iran. I don't think we'll have a credible foreign policy until we take action against Iran. Iran is the country responsible for Saddam Hussein today, responsible for the rise of terrorism. That was the country that initially under Truman seized Western oil. It was the country that seized our hostages. It was the country that gave the fatwa against Salman Rushdie. It has given every provocation to slap United States and the West in the face, and we have in every case begged, pleaded, and appeased in the face of that kind of incredible aggression across decades. As a result, Saddam Hussein and every little maniac around the world thinks they can do whatever they want. And the only solution is, in my opinion, to make a statement of our principles to the world and give Iran X number of days to atone for what they did, and in specific terms, or else let the bombs fly on Tehran. That's what I say.
Wow. All right. Phil, you're clapping for that. Are you going to agree with me? I can't believe it.
You're about to have a glory day.
You're kidding.
I think the three of us are in agreement.
You're kidding.
I think the three of us are in agreement. I think that my position as a liberal, and again, I'm not sure I'm always a traditional liberal, is I am an anti-totalitarian, whether that is of the right or of the left. I don't believe in totalitarianism. As Wilhelm Reich called it, the fascists, the red fascists and the black fascists, equally fascists. I think people like countries like Iran and Iraq are a grave threat to humanity. And the one justification for violence is always a grave threat to humanity. And so I could not disagree with one word Leonard just said. In terms of what Phyllis said, I'm probably a little softer on some of the treaties than she might be, but I would want to take those one at a time. She rattled off a fairly long list. There are probably some of those that I object to less than she does, but I think we are part of an international community, and we have to participate in that international community for our best interest. And I think that's the key to whether we sign a treaty or not. Is it for our best interest? But as far as fighting totalitarianism in any form, anywhere in the world, I think that is one of the legitimate roles of our government. And the fact that we are the last remaining superpower, we should exercise that muscle.
Interesting. All right, comment here.
I'm not going to disagree entirely with what all three of you have said. And in fact, in the first program, we discussed the fact that fascism and communism are really on the same end of the political spectrum. They're both totalitarian. It wasn't pointed out that Nazi was a German acronym for National Socialist Workers' Party. But the problem I'm having, what I'm hearing you say, is that the United States should go it alone. And the fact is it is of U.S. national interest to preserve our alliances with like-minded countries in Europe, Britain, and parts of the Middle East, Israel comes to mind, in Asia, and to take the position that the United States shouldn't do things to defend its allies like the NATO expansion, which is to preserve stability in Europe, our major trading partner and key ally for centuries, to promote stability in Asia, to do other things of this ilk, I think is short-sighted and ignores the fact that the United States needs its friends and should help them.
Right. Well, Phyllis, I give you the last word there.
Sure. Promoting stability in Asia means our paying billions of dollars of taxes to bail out these bankrupt regimes. I don't see why they should be saved any more than the mom and pop store in your local town that goes bankrupt. We say those are the breaks of the free market. Now, as far as NATO expansion is of no value to us, it is a commitment to send our troops to defend the borders in Eastern Europe, and there's nothing sacred about those borders. They mean nothing to the United States. They've been fighting about them for 1,000 years, and they're not worth one drop of our blood.
All right, Phil, last comment on that.
Well, I'm going to push a button or two here. For generations, for decades, we had a system where anyone who was anti-communist was our friend, even if they were a horrible right-wing fascist dictator, and we called them our friends. I think the first president in modern times that said that that's not the case was Jimmy Carter. He said, there is a definition of human rights and freedom in this country, and if you agree with and believe in that definition, you are our friend. If you don't, you are our enemy. I may side with you or help you if it is in my self-interest to do so, but I'm not going to call you my friend for doing it. And I think we have to return to that. I think that we need to define what it is to be the friend of America and support those people who, in fact, are friends of America and not support those people who aren't friends of America.
All right. Now, we've talked about several, I think, very important high-level issues. I'm going to ask the three of you now to drop back for a second and tell that person watching this program, as well as the audience here, what is it about your philosophy that makes you think this way? I'm searching for some continuity here that says my philosophy is this, or my set of values is this, and consequently, here's what I believe. Phil, let me begin with you.
Well, I grew up as a Jewish liberal from New Jersey, and I had instilled in me certain values about the world's relationship to other people. I elected to be an atheist as I got older because I wasn't willing to accept that blind leap of faith that we discussed earlier. But the values of enlightened self-interest, including circles of influence, which as those circles get bigger, the emotions may get weaker, but I still have to count that young lady standing at the hospital door, and I can't support her alone. I believe that there are certain minimum, and I mean minimum, acceptable standards of human behavior that we have to protect to be a civilized society, and I am willing to pay the price, and I guess what everybody would say is I'm willing to inflict the willingness to pay the price on everybody else.
On everybody else. Now, Leonard, your radio show, again, is called Philosophy, Who Needs It? Right. Give us your philosophy and how you come at your opinions about these issues.
I can condense it to three principles. I don't accept as a reliable conclusion anything except a rational, proven, logical statement based on sensory observation or inference therefrom. And on that basis, I reject all supernaturalism, all mysticism, and every idea that you can arrive at the answers to what's right or wrong by your feelings. When we get to ethics, I say, therefore, you don't define ethics on basis of emergency. You don't say there's a bleeding woman, how should you live? You say there's a human being who has a faculty of thought, that's his means of survival. What, therefore, is right or wrong to enable him to survive? And that's where I advocate the virtue of selfishness. Each man living by his own mind and for his own sake, neither sacrificing himself to others nor others to himself. A philosophy of each man being independent. He can give to charity and help others in need if it's no sacrifice involved, and if the recipient has the decency to say, thank you very much, I had no right to it just because I'm in need. My need does not entitle me to your life, but if you're good enough to help me in a moment of trouble, I appreciate it. If he would say that and you can help him out of the margins, that's okay. But as soon as somebody comes to me with or without pregnancy or blood and says, I'm in trouble, therefore I have a lean on your life, I say, bleed in front of my eyes. It's immoral to help that person. And the result of that is capital.
Phyllis, give us your philosophical underpinnings.
Well, to help the woman bleeding at the hospital door, there's no better answer than the Christian story of the Good Samaritan. But Jesus didn't say he's going to go around and confiscate money from everybody else to put her up at the Hilton Hotel. That isn't the way he did it. That is a matter of personal charity. When I look for the authority of living in a civilized country, I can't do any better than look to the Declaration of Independence and to the Constitution. The Declaration of Independence is our country's great religious document. It mentions God five times, and the Constitution is a very specific outline for delegated powers in a three-branch system of government. And if we just live up to it, I think it would be a much better society.
Phyllis, thank you for that. All right. And Phyllis, let me start again with you on this, really sort of the last issue that we have a chance to cover in depth. I think there will be some agreement from you and from other people here that one of the key issues still facing this country after all these decades, all these centuries, is racism. And in specific, of course, affirmative action, there are two different issues. One is sort of a side light of the other. Give us your thinking about the racism issue overall, and then specifically affirmative action.
Well, I do think the media do fan the flames that stir up racism to an unfortunate level. But on affirmative action, the big problem I have with that is that the person who's getting the benefit is not the person who was discriminated against. I think if you have been mistreated, you are entitled to a remedy. But I don't think you are entitled to a remedy because someone else was mistreated or was discriminated against. Affirmative action is about like saying that because at one time in this country women didn't have the right to vote, therefore today current women should have two votes and all men still only one. And that's what I think affirmative action is, and it really has no place. It's true we have some sins in the past, but again, I believe in remedying those to whom an injustice has been dealt, but I don't believe in giving that benefit to somebody else.
All right, Phil, it's up to you.
Well, if you reduce it to the individual, it's hard to argue that. But when you look at it on a societal level, clearly for generation after generation after generation, large groups of people in this country were discriminated against. Now, true, person A wasn't the one discriminated against, but surely they are reaping the pain or the disadvantage of those generations after generations after generations of discrimination. So at some point in time, somebody has to do something to offset that, and it is unfair everybody talks about the even playing field. If I'm on the even playing field, but I have to start 30 yards behind everybody else, I am at a disadvantage. I believe affirmative action not only creates the even playing field, but it puts those who are generationally deprived because of the sins of the past up to the same yard line that everybody else got to start at. And I believe we have an obligation to that.
Leonard.
I don't think you can solve a problem caused by racism without grasping what racism is. Racism is an elementary form, as Ayn Rand called it, a barnyard form of collectivism. Collectivism is the supremacy of the group above the individual. Racism is simply a primitive form of that. that you're elevating a racial group, a group defined by perceptual biological characteristics, above the individual. And if you want to know where this comes from, it comes from the fact that it's been preached by the public school system for generations and is being taught forcefully every day in the universities in the multiculturalist idea of you are not an American, you're a black, you're an Afro-American, you're a Chicano, you're a female, you're everything except an individual. These kids are having that pushed into them like poison. They come out proud of being racist. They call it being ethnic conscious, which is just a synonym for it. You're not going to solve a problem of racism by further racism, which is what affirmative action is. It's racism simply with a different race getting the rewards and a different race doing the sacrificing. You have to abandon the whole idea of the supremacy of the group over the individual. That would take a philosophic revolution. But it's the only hope. Otherwise, it's going to be a race war in this country, which is what it's coming to.
The late Austrian economist F.A. Hayek said this. He said, over the long run, it is a battle of ideas, and it is the intellectual, the journalist, novelist, filmmaker, and so on, who translates and transmits ideas of the scholars to the broader public, the intellectual who is critically important. He or she is the filter who decides what we hear, when we hear it, and how we hear it. Phil, your reaction to that quote.
It's clearly true. The guy on the street, going back to our issue of reading, doesn't read. Whether he can or not is irrelevant. The statistics are horrendous about who reads and what they read. So the man on the street is at the mercy of the media. So if you like what the media is saying, then you like what the population is getting. If you don't like what the media is saying, you don't like what the average person is getting. But the concept of independent thought is almost missing from our country. And I think it is the responsibility of the intellectual, as you describe them, to in fact not just disseminate information, but to disseminate the will or the passion for the individual to learn, to pick up the book and read it. Your program is a perfect example. You keep saying over and over again, and rightly so, that the issue here is not for me to convince Leonard that I'm right, or for Leonard to convince Phyllis that she is right. The issue here is for me to express an idea, and for Leonard to express an idea, and for Phyllis to express an idea, so that the person watching the show might just take a few minutes out and think about it, and maybe pick up a book and read more about it. And it would almost be worth it for me to contradict something I agreed with, just to get somebody to think about the idea. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the responsibility of the writer, of the filmmaker, of the news media, and that is to get people to think.
On your radio show, Leonard, you talk about a variety of issues, from Princess Diana to Mother Teresa's death and everything else. What are you trying to do? What are you trying to accomplish there?
Well, it's called Philosophy Who Needs It? And my point is to teach people that the whole course of history and the present state of the world and our future depends on philosophy. That whether they know it or not, people accept a certain philosophy. Today, unfortunately, they accept unreason and self-sacrifice as their basic unquestioned pillars. Many people do. And a whole establishment works to pushing those ideas in them. And the result of that is horrendous. What we need is a philosophy of reason and selfishness and individualism. But not to propagandize for the content, philosophy shapes every person's life knowingly or otherwise. You cannot be interested in chemistry or astrophysics and won't necessarily influence you, but you can't avoid some idea of what is good or bad and some idea of how to reach conclusions. Phil talks about thinking. What is sound thinking and what isn't? And that's what philosophy teaches you. And my program is about trying to show the role of philosophy in everyday issues.
Phyllis, you reach millions of people every week through your columns, your commentaries, and of course your talk show as well. Respond to what they've said, please.
Well, I would take a little different point of view. I think personality and leadership are just as important as ideas. And as we have a nation now that is about 50% semi-literate, I think personality and leadership will be even more important. And unfortunately, I'm sorry that great millions of people in this country will be led not by ideas, but by sound bites. The media have become very important. I do think if you look at conservatism, that the leadership and the personality of Ronald Reagan were every bit as important as the ideas. He articulated them, but you have to have a means of carrying it out. And I really do hope that we will develop more the literacy of our country, because I think that if you're going to care about ideas, you have got to be able to read big books, read about our history, read about the great heroes of the past.
Phyllis, it's so difficult in an era of 9-second soundbites, isn't it?
It certainly is.
What would you do to that individual watching this program right now in about 9 seconds that would encourage them to look for the kind of knowledge that you're talking about?
My dream is that we can once again become a nation in which every family teaches their own children to read at home, so they will be able to read big books and know about the greatness of our country. That's my hope.
Phyllis, I really appreciate your joining us, and Leonard, you and Phil here in the studio, and all our fabulous audience. You know, America is and has been great for many years, and one reason is that we have been able to engage in intelligent dialogue about issues such as these. Ideas do matter. Philosophy matters. Persuasion seems to me a better alternative than force, and ultimately, those with the better facts and ideas should prevail. Now, we hope that you've enjoyed this most lively dialogue about things that matter. These folks, as you can tell, really care, and so do we. Thank you for inviting us in.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.